You're listening to Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Browdy, and she is Marjorie Egan. 2 years ago, our guest performed the first full face transplant in the United States. And just recently, as you know, he performed the fifth at Brigham Women's on a Vermont woman whose husband had hit her in the head with a baseball bat, then threw industrial-strength lye all over. I cannot tell a lie. I am in awe of this man. Joining us online from Brigham and Women's Hospital is the Director of Plastic Surgery Transplantation and the Medical Director of the Burn Center there. Welcome to Boston Public Radio, Dr. Bowden Pomahawk. Welcome, Doctor.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
And to you.
Thrilled to have you with us, Doctor. Before we get to the most recent transplant, the facial transplant, the woman from Vermont, I read a fascinating story about your coming to the Brigham and Women's from Czechoslovakia, I believe, and to convincing the hospital to even go this route of the facial transplants. Tell us how that happened.
Well, thank you. I thought I could almost follow your previous discussion, but I graduated from medical school in the Czech Republic, actually, and saw that the United States had the best organized postgraduate education system for surgeons, and essentially traveled across the ocean with what I thought was money for 3 months, but in Boston environment was probably good for only about a month, and determined to find a job or go back. And I was determined to try research for several years to be exposed to it, but also to get to know the academic environment a little bit more, and everything seemed to work out very well. So here I am, almost 17 years later.
Well, you're being too modest. You came with $3,000, and then you worked for free to get yourself, right?
Yeah, I did. I did. I offered to work for free, and I did for a few months, and then actually received a stipend. So, I was determined.
And how did you – because when you came here, obviously, there were no face transplants going on. The first one, I believe, was 2006 in France. So what obstacles did you face getting this program going?
Right. Well, when I came, I actually didn't even know I wanted to be a plastic surgeon. I certainly knew I wanted to be trained in surgery, but the field itself didn't come apparent until I – during my stay here, realized and found fascination in plastic surgery. And the fundamental element and part of plastic surgery was really the facial reconstruction and in general, facial surgery. So when I started in practice in 2004, I happened to take care of a large number of patients with really horrendous facial deformities from either burn trauma or even head and neck cancer. And that's where, despite the fact I just received the best training you can imagine, I was able to employ any possible technique there is. I still felt like the outcomes were fairly suboptimal. And that's how I got to the topic of transplantation.
If you want to talk to this man who stands alone at the top of his field, Dr. Bowden Pomahawk, you can give him a buzz at 877-301-8970. As I said, Doctor, you did the first full face transplant in the United States. I think it was on a guy from Texas. How nervous were you when you were performing this first surgery with your colleagues?
Well, I would really want to make clear that this is an incredible team effort. Mm-hmm. And although I lead the initiative and I'm a lead surgeon on the face transplants, there certainly are numerous people without whom we would never really get these complex operations accomplished. So I really have to give credit to the entire team of surgeons, but also all the other physicians taking care of our patients, transplant, et cetera, infectious disease. I could probably name them for 5 minutes. But going back to your question, it certainly was incredibly stressful. There were a number of things that were not going quite right according to the plan that evening and that night. We had to change start of the operation. There was fog in the Logan Airport, delaying arrivals of many airplanes, including some of our colleagues that were trying to head back to Boston. And in midst of that, we were actually not having donor locally in Boston, but had to travel elsewhere in New England, which complicated things furthermore. So it wasn't going smoothly logistically, but fortunately, everything went smoothly surgically.
We're talking with Dr. Bowden Pomahawk, who's been doing facial surgeries at the Brigham and Women's. I read a piece about this particular surgery that talked about, Doctor, how, and I didn't realize this, that a donor in this particular case was donating, the person who had died was donating not only his face, but also other organs. So you had to perform the face surgery first and still allow the other doctors to get the other organs, it puts you in a terrible time constraint.
Yeah, so that's actually not an unusual scenario. Typically, the donation, of course, of the life-saving organs takes precedence. We all keep in mind that even though our patients live horrendous lives, deformed, we still have people that otherwise, and patients that would otherwise die if they don't receive their life-saving organs. So our part of the operation goes first because it's so time-consuming, but at the same time doesn't really change the stability of the donor. In other words, all the subsequent recoveries can proceed in proper order, while the time that we have for the tissues without blood perfusion would be too long if we would start in the end. So that's been clearly communicated at the beginning with our great partners at the New England Organ Bank, and that's how every operation occurs. But it's not unusual that the organs are recovered, although sometimes the time pressure factor of speed is important.
We're talking to Dr. Pamahak, who did the most recent phase transplant, remarkable transplant of this Vermont woman. We'll talk about that in a couple of minutes. We had a medical ethicist on a couple of days ago talking about phase transplants, obviously off your most recent surgery. And there were a couple of things he said that I have to say I hadn't thought about before, doctor. Number one was this, the donor. I did one of those things where you do on your license and you say you donate your organs if you're dead. And just like this ethicist said, I never thought that I might be donating my face. And while I like to think, you know, dead is dead and I want to do something good that can help somebody else, do you still find reluctance on the part of potential donors? It's one thing to take my liver, my heart, my another organ, but taking my face is a whole other kettle of fish.
Right. Well, we as surgeons never really directly communicated with donor families. We have a great team of experts that are employed and organized and run by New England Organ Bank, and those family coordinators are the ones that approach families for donation. And you're right, no one expects, if you cross the box just like I did on my driver's license, to be a donor. No one expects that anybody would take their upper lower extremities or face. And that's why there is very specific and very separate process to obtain consent for these unique type of tissues. So no one has to be worried that this would happen to them without their consent.
Well, a second issue he raised was this, is that most of us grew up with transplants being to save lives. You do transplants in some cases to save lives. I'm talking about faces, of course, but more for a quality of life issue. And the ethicist said there are some concerns about what should be priorities. How do you respond to those sort of concerns, Dr. Pamahak?
Yeah. I think those are very valid points, and this is important differentiator between what we do versus organ transplant surgeons. I think that we have to go back a little bit in history and think of the first kidney transplant. It was at the time of dialysis that it was developing as very promising technology that can replace function of kidneys, and on the other hand, transplantation was early surgical technique that in most instances led to loss of the kidney or even death of the patient. And it wasn't really clear which one of the technologies will be better and ultimately will succeed. So you have to sometimes look back 20 years worth of data and be able to dissect. And in this case, it was found that actually kidney transplantation prolongs survival of the patients and makes patients live longer. So ultimately is better than dialysis. But we may be in similar crossroad in history. We don't quite know whether our quality of life improving operations will ultimately translate into something like that. You could argue that some patients with the most severe facial deformities may not be able to participate in life, may commit suicide, may have reasons to commit suicide, while when they're fixed, they can get back to their productive lives, they can be deployed, hopefully, back in army and so forth. So there are probably other outcomes that we have to analyze over a period of time and figure out how much value we really add to our patients.
We're talking with Dr. Bowden Pamahak, who has performed these facial transplants at Brigham and Women's Hospital. Doctor, bring us back to the operating room. Well, before you even get to the operating room, the surgery involving the man named Dallas, who had been severely injured, you had to fly off to the operating room to remove the face from the donor and then fly the face back to Boston. So tell us, how do you remove a face? And how do you know how to do it? Where do you practice?
Right. This is probably the most unique part of the operation, and this is where I think we have pioneered the technique itself. No one has really done anything like that before in the context or extent that we have done, but to great extent, every operation so far is a little bit like Mona Lisa. Everyone is a tiny bit different from the previous one. So it is still in the very early phases of identifying how to do this. I think the fundamental plan is focused on making sure that we actually analyze what the recipient patient's missing, and we plan what tissues we need to have included from the donor so that the facial part would not only contain what it needs structurally, but also functionally. And that includes not just the nose, hard palate, teeth, and things like that, but also the nerves that ultimately will provide sensation to the new face and will provide the recipient with the ability to control the muscles of facial motion. So that's sort of the blueprint. And then we actually did go to an anatomy lab and started dissecting on cadavers, trying to figure out what is the best surgical way to accomplish it for particular patients. And then later on, it has sort of become a one operation that can be modified based on the patient.
So you're not just taking skin, you're taking nerves. And then you have to transport it. How do you transport the face, the skin, and the nerves once you've got it?
Yeah. So we dissect the skin, but also the underlying subcutaneous tissue. We include the muscles, we include the nerves that power the muscles and nerves that provide sensation to the face. The entire unit has to stay perfused. So the fundamental number one goal is to reestablish blood flow, which will keep that part alive. In other words, it's not going to live off some sort of diffusion of nutrients from the underlying wound bed, but it has to have its own circulation, its own blood supply. And that means we have to plan an artery for inflow and vein for outflow, and typically they're one of each on each side of the face. After that, the actual transport and preservation is done similarly what organ transplant surgeons do, which is we perfuse with preserving solution this unit and then bring it cooled so that we reduce the metabolic demand, which means the demand of the cells for nutrients, to the minimum until we bring it to the recipient and reconnect it again.
This is just amazing. This is just unbelievable. It's like another world. Go ahead.
You know, doctor. I was just going to add that we have only 4 hours since from the time we disconnect the vessels to the time we reestablish the blood flow. After that, the unit may not live or may not live properly.
You know, this is the voice of Dr. Boden Pomok. And, Doctor, unfortunately, you're on a line from Brigham Women's. You're not here watching us shaking our heads as you're speaking.
Yeah, I can't believe it.
And in my case, I'm shaking my head because I would get nauseous when I had to dissect a frog at my freshman year in college, and I'm listening to you. I'd like you to listen also. This is the sister of Carmen Tarleton. She's the Vermont woman, age 44, on whom you performed the most recent face transplant surgery. Listen to her.
I'm reading a statement directly from Carmen. She says, I feel great appreciation and gratitude for the tremendous gift that I've been given. This greatly improves my quality of life and physical comfort level. My spirits are high. I feel really good and happy. This is a momentous opportunity in my life, and I want to convey to the donor's family what a great gift they've given to me.
That was shortly after the surgery. And again, if you want to speak to Dr. Pomahawk, you can call him at 877-301-8970. You know, as an outsider, doctor, I want to talk to you about adjustment issues. As an outsider, you hear something like that, and we've heard some of the transplant patients speak, and there's utter joy in their voices. But what's the psychology? You have an original face. Then you go to horrible disfigurement. And then all of a sudden, you have a face that originally was not yours. Again, as an outsider, I say, God, that's got to be cause for great exultation, but is there psychological adjustment that's hard for your patients?
Well, I think you nicely described the phases, and the only caveat to that is that the time of disfigurement typically lasts years for the mm-hmm. patient. So it is no longer the original face that they're identifying themselves or wishing for. That's gone, but the uniform response from the patients we have seen is this great joy that they actually could get a new face, look human again. And the little imperfections really are not bothering them, certainly not until 6-12 months later, and then we can often adjust or do little adjustments to make sure that they're happy.
But I don't even mean the imperfections. I mean the notion that, assuming you have sight, and I know some of these patients were blinded by whatever caused the disfigurement, you see yourself in a mirror, not a month, day later, but a month later, 6 months later. Is there any disconnect, or is it all happiness that finally I look, as you say, human again?
I think we have not seen, and we follow it very carefully, both our psychiatrist on our team as well as the family members, and we have not seen any problems with adjustments. And I think, again, it's related to the magnitude of difference and change. I think what we will see, if these cases go well, patients are doing well, and suddenly the indication shifts towards smaller deformity, I think we'll see a little bit more complicated responses from our patients, because there will not be perhaps as dramatic improvement or as not as huge as it currently happens. So right now it has not been really an issue.
Our numbers are 877-301-8970 if you'd like to ask a question of Dr. Pomahawk. Before we go to the calls here, I just wanted to mention, in many of these stories I've read, Doctor, and you know this a million times better than I, patients talk about how their children's friends didn't want to come over to their houses because their mother or their father had these terrible disfigurements, how the woman that was attacked by the ape didn't attend her daughter's graduation because she knew it would upset people so much, or upset her daughter. And that's obviously what you've changed.
Right. I think we are really addressing the fundamental sort of mirror of our souls, but our humanity, our ability to belong to society and faces, from that standpoint, incredibly important. You really communicate with your face, even without moving it. And lack of face is clearly associated with isolation, with scaring people. And I can't even imagine how difficult life must be.
Let's go to the phones. We're talking to Dr. Bowden Pomahawk from Brigham and Women. Again, he just did the fifth face transplant of Brigham and Women's, and he did the first full face transplant ever in the United States several years ago. Nancy from Ashford, Connecticut. You're on with Dr. Pomahawk.
Thank you. I was interested in his comment about transplanting the nerve mm-hmm. and reestablishing feeling. I had understood that nerves did not regenerate, and I was wondering how he managed to do that and what his success rate is.
That's a great question. How about it, Doctor?
Yeah, it is a great question, and I think there is a common sort of confusion about how nerves regenerate. So the nerve body, actually, as long as that is intact, the nerve can regenerate, and the nerve body in this case is in the brain. So we don't know how to fix problems related to brain injury or spinal cord injury, but peripheral nerve, when transected, and peripheral nerve includes the nerves that provide sensation in the face, when reconnected, they actually do parts of the nerve outgrow back to the effector muscle. And the limitation really is only time. If it takes a long time for the nerve to reach the muscle that it's supposed to power, then the muscle may be atrophic to the point where it may no longer move, even if the nerve reaches it. But on the face, fortunately, the distances are relatively short, and we see a relatively rapid motor sort of return. And rapid means 3-6 months time.
Nancy, thank you very much for the call. We're talking to Dr. Bowden Pomahawk, who is doing facial transplants at Brigham and Women's Hospital. Our numbers are 877-301-8970. Doctor, I wonder, you've done several of these now. Is it four or five? I should know this. I've forgotten it. Is it four or five of these have you done?
We have done a total of five transplants.
Okay.
The first one was partial. The four were full face transplants.
And so what happens after the patient leaves the hospital? The big concern, I assume, is rejection of the tissue or infection. What are the big worries
right.
post-operatively?
So there are almost phases that relate to certain sort of high incidence of particular type of complications. So the first 24 hours after the operation, anything can go wrong with reconnection of the blood vessels. They can clot, they can close up, and of course there would be immediate threat to loss of the face. After the 24 hours, within about first week, we see a peak in infection rates, and that puts the patient at a risk of developing either at the surgical site or elsewhere infections at the time when their immune system is suppressed the most. And then after that, approximately 2 weeks after the operation, it's really more related to tailoring the immune suppression medications, making sure that we get to the ranges and we eliminate the side effects, and patients are generally doing well. But the rejection is always a concern and can occur any time in the patient's life afterwards.
We have a lot of calls. We'll get to them in a second. Doctor, I just got an email. How much do these surgeries cost, and who pays for them?
Right. Right now, this is considered a clinical experimental procedure, and it's an experimental protocol that was, as a researcher, funded by Department of Defense Biomedical Translational Initiative.
Wow.
We received $3.4 million with recent additional funds to study, exactly for the reasons mentioned before, the outcomes of the transplantation. And we collect, of course, cost data, and we know that the average cost at the present time is about $250,000 per patient. Now, we have to take into consideration that every new technology is remarkably expensive, and then with more experience, greater efficiency, the cost can dramatically decrease.
Let's go to Shoba from Ashland. She's on the phone. Thank you for calling, Shoba. You're on with Dr. Tomahawk.
Hi. How are you doing?
Great.
Oh, thanks.
I had a question about how exact do the measurements have to be? Is there any stretching involved? I mean, do you have to have exact measurements of foreheads and cheeks and everything?
Yeah, that's actually a great question, and it brings also an issue: how do we know that the donor will actually match recipient in terms of skeletal and soft tissues match? And we're actually trying to investigate that part. In general, we try to take a little extra and then trim it as we need. But we are working very hard on developing certain landmarks and as simple as possible that would allow us to know upfront whether this particular match is going to be good or not.
Hey, Shoba, thank you for the call. We appreciate it.
You know, Doctor, I remember reading in one of the stories how I think it was in the Dallas case where the gentleman the donor who had died, he was a much heavier man than the transplant recipient. So how do you work that out? He was a bulky guy and the recipient was kind of a skinny guy, or at least a slight guy.
You really read all the details.
I am transfixed by this, Doctor. Let me tell you, I am more fascinated by this than almost anything I've read about in years. I mean, I'm thrilled. So how do you manage that?
Well, yeah, in that case, it was, I think, for the first time where we encountered something like that, fairly dramatic difference in overall sort of body size. And from that time, we sort of asked, and when we collaborated with the New England Organ Bank, we asked for that data up front. But it brought on some challenges. There was a little bit of more tissue than what we really needed. It was a little bit harder to make it fit. But in the end, it worked out well, and we had to tighten up the skin, actually, I think, maybe even a couple of times in Dallas's case. But it is what actually brought our attention to how do we better define and refine what donor would be good match, and how far you can push that difference between donor and recipient in terms of its body habitus, but also the differences related to their shape and size of face.
You know, Dr. Pomahawk, when you get home tonight, if there's a blonde in a yellow sweater waiting for you at your door,
Right. Say
hello to Marge Regan. Doris from Pelham, New Hampshire, you're on with Dr. Bowden Pomahawk. Welcome, Doris.
Thank you. I just have praise for you, doctor. You did surgery on my neck in 2004, and I was there with facial and neck burns, and I just always remember you, and I've been following all you've accomplished, and I get emotional, but I just wanted to call and praise you because I think it's wonderful what you're doing. Thank you so much.
That is beautiful, Doris.
Doris,
we're really
thank
glad
you very
called.
Much for the call. Doctor, how old are you?
My birthday is in 3 days. I'll be 42.
Happy birthday,
you're still,
doctor.
So you began this whole thing, obviously, when you were still in your 30s. Wow.
Yep.
What were you doing when you were 36, Jim?
I was 37. Learning how to cook, actually. Let's let's squeeze one more in for Dr. Pomahawk. Jerry, you're in Wellesley, and you're on with Dr. Bowden Pomahawk.
Hello, doctor. Just a quick question. given that each of us has different facial constructions, and I would assume you try to match similar faces, I was wondering how much difference there is, given those differences in facial construction, between the person's old good face and the person's new good face. Is it slightly different, radically different?
Yeah, it's a very good question, and I think we, at the present time, are not perhaps as selective as we may be in the future. Right now, there are so many things to match that the exact size of facial skeleton that actually seems to be fairly conserved in humans in general is not a factor that would eliminate a donor. So there are tissue characteristics, there's a sex, age, color of skin, all these things that may preclude us from using particular type of tissues from a donor. But I think we're just now dwelling on this exact issue, and I can tell you that we're finding out that there is certainly greater variability in skeletal structures of male patients as opposed to female. So in the future, we'll probably see very likely matches for female patients, regardless of the skeletal or soft tissue differences, while in male patients it may be a little bit more difficult. But we don't quite know to what extent that may become a kind of a yes or no factor, whether to proceed with the operation or not.
Jerry, thanks for the call. Dr. Pamuk, what's the next frontier in transplantation surgery? Most of us would never have believed you could transplant a face. What are people like you thinking about next?
Well, I think what we are at the very beginning of is what I would call a restorative surgery, something that has not been feasible before, something that allows us to really replace very complex tissue parts of the human body. And until we figure out other ways, I think that this may be a very suitable technology to not only replace faces and upper extremities, but push it a little further to perhaps combinations of upper and lower extremities, perhaps abdominal wall in suitable patients, and other type of either war-related injuries, trauma, or perhaps even tumor-related operations. I think in the big picture, though, we are all striving to minimize the immune suppression. That's really the roadblock that doesn't allow us to really move freely forward because we still have to keep in mind the pros and cons, the benefits that we provide to the patient, and the risks associated with lifetime therapy. And I feel that we're somewhat, perhaps in an analogy to Dr. Joe Murray, who performed the first kidney transplant, we're at a similar crossroads in history. When he performed the first kidney transplant, it was successful in identical twins, and no one really saw immediate future for a large amount of patients because there was no immune suppression available. And it took about 10 years to figure out that radiation didn't work and that we needed chemical immune suppression, and ultimately the first drug was developed. And I hope that we're in similar crossroads where we still have to use the common immune suppressants, but hopefully within 10 years we'll figure out a way how to allow the human body to tolerate these type of foreign tissues without medications, and that would certainly open frontiers of restorative surgery, really breaking down all limits.
Dr. Pamuk, last question from me is, you mentioned, I think I got the number, a $3.4 million grant from the Department of Defense. Is your work affected in any way by this sequester situation that we are talking about virtually nonstop?
As far as we know, we have not been, I think it will affect the future of funding opportunities, and to what extent, I really can't tell.
Dr. Pamuk, thank you so much for your time. It's terrific.
What a thrill to talk to you, Doctor, and congratulations to you and to your unbelievably courageous patients who are just so grateful. It breaks your heart to read what they've said about how your operation has changed their lives. Congratulations.
Thank you, Doctor.
Thank you very much on behalf of all our team.
Thank you.
We appreciate it.
Okay, that was Dr. Boden Pamuk. He, of course, is the Director of Plastic Surgery Transplantation and Medical Director at Brigham and Women's Burn Center. I mean, I just can't even believe this guy. Anyway, up next is open mic, back to the real world here.
I can't believe this
guy. I can't. I mean, it's just so amazing. Up next is Boston Globe editor Brian McGrory. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.